The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins is brought to you by 74 Seconds, a new podcast discussing the story of Philando Castile. Make sure you listen in for that spot later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. I should also warn you that the language in this week's addendum is a bit strong. Just want to give you a heads up. Enjoy the program.
Dee Watkins here with Undisclosed, the killing of Freddie Gray. Today, I'm lucky to be joined by my co-host, Justine Barron. Justine is a political and nonprofit consultant by day and a film and TV writer by night. Her clients have included the Cesar Chavez Foundation, Columbia University, Anti-Defamation League, and many others. She also writes a column on crime and media for the Jewish Journal. My good friend Baynard Woods, the founder and editor of Democracy in Crisis, a weekly column and podcast syndicated in 20 alternative weekly papers. He's editor-at-large at Baltimore City Paper. He covered criminal justice in Baltimore for The Guardian and is the author of Coffin Point, The Strange Cases of Ed McTeer, Witch Doctor Sheriff, a book about the white policing of black communities in the early 20th century. He writes opera libretti with rhymes with opera and has a PhD in philosophy. Also has the coolest collection of sunglasses attached to chains in the world. And Aaron Morrison. Aaron is a senior staff writer for the movement at Mike. He covers the intersection of race, justice, politics, diversity, and civil rights. He has previously written for IB Times, Miami Herald, the Bergen Record of New Jersey, and the Associated Press. How you guys doing today?
Good.
Yeah, very good.
Doing great. Thanks.
So I feel like we should start today with fake news, because if I can put my bio out there based on how Donald Trump gets his news, I could say I was the first, the second, the third, the eighth, and the 15th black president. I scored 7 million on the SAT, averaged 20,000 points a game at North Carolina University, and invented denim jackets. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, it's like some of these people, they make these things up as they go. And, you know, I'm here with a panel full of great journalists, and I'm sure you guys have a lot to say and surely take offense to your profession just being dragged through the mud.
Yeah, I mean, even just this morning, and yesterday, after a reporter was, a former colleague of mine and a Baltimorean, Ben Jacobs, a Guardian reporter, was body slammed in Montana, the president takes to Twitter the next morning after that, the body slammer wins the special election and starts complaining about fake news, essentially defending, you know, a politician for attacking, physically attacking a reporter.
You knew the guy that got body slammed.
Yeah, yeah. He's from here, in fact, from Baltimore.
Yeah. Justine?
I'm not a reporter, so I approach this all really differently. I feel like it gives me a lot of freedom to talk about the news however I see it. I have talked to a lot of reporters through this process, and you know, being from like outside of Baltimore now and outside of reporting, and I worried a lot getting into this project that I was an outsider, but I think it's all just been like it's been a positive to have that freedom and independence to make friends with reporters, or not friends, but be friendly, have friendly conversations, and then say, hey, you know, can you tell me something about what you were doing with these articles? And they say, I can't talk about it. And then I feel liberated to write and critique their work, because I don't need to deal with them later. You know what I mean? I don't need to worry about having each other's back as reporters. I don't know. Do you think that goes on? I feel like that might go on a little bit.
I don't know, because for me, being like with City Paper, we were created to criticize the Sun, and it was what it was the alternative to. And then when we got bought by the Sun, took even a more critical approach towards what was happening. So I think at a lot of times, no. But then, yeah, when you feel like, I hate CNN, but when I hear the president attacking CNN, I want to stand up for CNN. And so it's sort of like that family thing. If it's someone outside attacking a politician or something, then journalists do want to defend each other. But if it's another, you know, media criticism, I think, is one of the most important things that we should be doing, as keeping each other honest.
Yeah.
How did you feel about it, Aaron? Have you felt like just a major disrespect toward what you do every day? for the mic?
So let me start here. I cover the movement. I primarily cover the movement for Black Lives. Mm-hmm. And so often I'm out and about, and if you see me on the street, usually at a protest or whatever, I may be standing close to where the activists are standing. And sometimes I will worry, like, oh, okay, do people know that I'm a journalist here, or do they think I'm another one of the BLM activists? And certainly I don't take offense when someone thinks I am an activist, but I certainly have sort of come to peace with the notion that when you cover news in this space, especially in the social justice space, people often think that you have an axe to grind, or that you want to promote one side over another. And really, I'm just focused on telling the truth. That is my primary concern, is that did I tell this truth? Did this story have, you know, a mixture of both sides, getting an opportunity to speak in my piece, but is the truth there? And I think there is a right and a wrong, and I'm okay with calling right right and wrong wrong, and not being hung up by, you know, folks' criticism about whether or not I'm being too harsh to one side or not harsh enough on another. So Donald Trump's attacks, I just kind of have laughed at them, because it just seems to be that everything he calls fake news is something that is very journalistic, very much in line with the core principles of journalism. And it's all things that don't make him look good. So of course he's going to call it fake news.
He said Meryl Streep was washed up. That's crazy. Like, you just say anything. Say anything. And it's like, to so many people, it's becoming normal. It's becoming normal to just not appreciate people that are out there doing real work, to the point where, again, a dude was slammed. It seems like the profession is just like, we're living in difficult times right now. But what I would like to say, even dealing with like some of these more major publications, is how real is some of the news coming out when we're reporting on some things like what happened to Freddie Gray? Because the police officers are saying one thing. Some people at the paper are rushed to give glowing, I think they might have been your words, Justine, glowing articles. I think it was Justin George's articles about the police officers and how they were noble and courageous and heroes, and you know, he wants to quit his job as a journalist and go get an honorary badge, you know?
Actually, no, I think that's right on point. Like, from me talking to some reporters, and I have to say, sorry to say it, but especially white male reporters, at least in this particular area that I've been covering, there's this very subtle alliance with the cops. And I get it, because I have been talking to retired police officers and I've made friends with them. And it's a very special set of knowledge they have. We don't understand policing. I feel like I understand it a lot more, and I walk around feeling kind of smart. And that's how I feel like some of these reporters are. And I think that maybe without even being entirely conscious of it, they are receiving police information as truth. They're tipping their hat to the other side, you know, because that's their job. So their article might be 75. We did some highlighting projects where we would take an article, we would highlight how much of it was the police point of view versus the community point of view. And, you know, it usually skewed that way. And mostly the Baltimore Sun that I'm talking about. But yeah, I think it's when you make friends with cops, it feels special, not necessarily and entirely in a good way, but
But anybody you make friends with is going to probably be represented in a better way, like in an article. Like, if you're making friends with a community member who has a totally different perspective on policing than actual police, then you would probably, you know, write something positive about them. But I feel like maybe these voices still aren't getting a chance to be heard.
People like the powerful people. I think that's why.
I feel that there's something to that, but I feel like it's a little bit more complicated. And so, I mean, we were always at City Paper, and even when I was with The Guardian, far from being associated with the police. They still, I think, really hate me, and no police are friends with me. And so people, you know, like with Aaron, people mistook us for...
The former mayor doesn't like you too much either, just to throw that out there.
Right, so people mistook us for protesters rather than for... And I mean, one of the important things was on the Saturday night after Camden Yards, the police attacked Joe Giordano, City Paper photographer, and also Wire photographer out at, and that we were almost the only press out at the Western District, and they just stomped on Joe, and I ended up getting that on film. But I do think that Justin George and Justin Fenton have a different thing where they seem, when they're out and about, people maybe mistake them for cops, but I don't think they're trying to be, I mean, I know that Justin George had been assigned to the next fit case, whatever it was, I think, and seemed sort of miserable being confined, like, because everything was embargoed. He couldn't communicate any of that information. And so I think some of it is more the institutional structure of large daily papers. It's not the reporters.
So it's like his job versus like the truth?
I mean, like, so right before that, Fenton was blackballed by Batts entirely, who wouldn't acknowledge Fenton at anything because he had reported something Batts didn't like. So I think they're willing to, but every, with a big thing like that, they're trying to get the whole picture with all of their stories, and they often miss. But I don't think that any of the individual reporters are trying to skew a different way. It's that institutions favor institutions in some way. That the Sun as feels like it's this thing in Baltimore, that it has to be in with the police and the state's attorneys. And I don't know. I don't know what it is, but it feels more complicated than they're just friends with the cops.
I mean, but it's still not really right, though, because it's like one-sided. Like, you kind of lose a certain amount of credibility if you have to cave to other organizations, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm endlessly frustrated that they write stories that say, based on, like, with the Keith Davis case, so the first person who was shot here in Baltimore after Freddie Gray's death, the Sun immediately reported that he had a gun, that he shot at them, and it was according to police report. But then 6 months later, everyone forgot according to police report, and people just thought that's what happened, and they didn't go out and find the other people. We did, but it's endlessly frustrating.
Last July, a Facebook Live video shocked the country. You might remember it. It was hard to watch. It showed Philando Castile bleeding to death in the front seat of his white Oldsmobile. He'd been shot by a police officer during a routine traffic stop outside St. Paul, Minnesota. The video was viewed millions of times. Now, that officer, Geronimo Yanez, is on trial in Castile's death. A new podcast from Minnesota Public Radio takes a deep dive into this case, asking, what happened that night? And what happens when a police officer goes on trial? The podcast is called 74 Seconds. 74 Seconds is how long that whole traffic stop took. 74 seconds from the flashing lights to the final shot. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts and follow this case throughout the trial.
After we aired Justin Fenton's glowing stories about Batts when Batts first came on, because Batts had a really troubled history that never got reported in Baltimore, or, you know, barely, you know, he said, it's ridiculous to say that we were friends. And I get that. Maybe it's just sort of this, okay, here's the culture. You have to report almost every single day.
Yeah.
And you're getting fed stuff from the defense team. You're getting fed stuff from the police. That now is your story. And then you have to have another story the next day. So it may not be a friendship thing so much as sort of facilitating their jobs in an easy way. And then it's like, you're absolutely right that it's sort of up to the editors. The editors can turn, not to say any of these people are, but lazier reporters into better report. You know, those are choices that need to come from the editors. If the editors are happy that one of their reporters has an inside connection with someone from the defense that's getting fed everything, then that's where the problem is.
But you don't really go through these things, Aaron, because you're not really, you don't have to answer to any, you cover the movement, so you don't have to answer to any big structures and as far as like some of the places you've been.
Well, I can say that on the flip side of this, and I, of course, won't name any names, but you can write the wrong angle on a story and an activist group will stop talking to you because they didn't like the way you framed it. I mean, in my effort to be fair in the way I report a lot of these stories, you know, social justice issues or at least the pursuit of reform after a shooting has happened, you don't always please both sides. And generally, if neither side is pleased, I feel like I'm probably doing my job. But, you know, generally, I can say there have been certain instances where I've written a story and I get I get iced out for, for a couple of weeks because for whatever reason, they didn't think I was going to write the story that way. So I think this exists on both sides. It can exist with the police. It can exist within the community. If the community feels like you aren't representing them or amplifying their voices, yeah, maybe they might say, well, yeah, we don't really trust this reporter, but we do trust these other reporters. And the same with police and law enforcement institutions.
Like kind of like how this story came about with Freddie Gray's back. How it started, it was a fake news story that turned into like a real thing.
Yeah. That one's deep. I think what's especially insidious in this story, and this is actually where I become a little cautious with the news about Donald Trump. It's like, yeah, you know, personally, I would like them all to go down. But these are all anonymously leaked stories, probably from very powerful people with their own political interests. And so I've seen this play out in the Freddie Gray case. I mean, I have some pretty good idea that some of the people that are still leading the Baltimore Police Department were responsible for telling one false story after the other right before the charges came down because they knew they were coming down. That, to me, just for me studying this entire case, 16 episodes, is some of the worst of it. You know, that's how I feel. Like, that is really dark, really effed up, you know?
Like, explain.
To be a police deputy commissioner and calling your friends in journalism a couple of days before you know cops are going to be charged and making up fake stories, distorting the autopsy report that you've seen about how a young man died is really bad. Do you know what I mean? I think that, I don't know, that just takes it to a whole other really creepy level. It's one thing to give press conferences and say, we haven't seen any signs of force. That sucks. They hadn't even started investigating. But to literally leak these things and know that they are going to become canon, people are going to believe them. And then the bad backstory, I mean, that was cops creating these fake narratives. And I mean, that's just, this stuff is bad.
It's crazy
to me
because it's like, I'm not surprised by it. And I don't want to sound like Captain Jaded every time I speak on one of these issues, but it's like, what police officer doesn't lie? What police officer really truly gives a fuck about a black person from a neighborhood like where Freddie was from? Like, they just don't.
But we're talking about a very, very coordinated effort from the entire department.
And?
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. I hear you.
It's what they do. Like, I saw police officers tell grandmothers, shut the fuck up and go back in the house. I seen police officers, like, spit on people, like, fuck little kids up, like, lock up people. That's what I'm saying. Like, I really, really think, like, half of them got some type of mental health issue. Like, they really crazy. So, like, when I hear these things, it's like, damn, am I even, like, the person to even had this conversation with? Because I'm just never shocked. It's like, you could tell me that, you know, the police officer such and such just went inside of Johns Hopkins Hospital and ate 4 infants from the baby ward. And I'm going to be like, oh, all right, cool. Yo, what y'all going to get from lunch?
Where's the media then? Like, they're getting handed these stories and from one day to the next being like, oh, okay, he had a bad back. Sorry, not a bad back. He banged his head.
You got people like Boehner who's out there finding truth and trying to tell these stories. But he's like a one. Like, you know, there's some other people, too, that do good work. And that's, you know, in this city that's constantly trying to find truth. But, like, he don't get greeted with open. He don't get, like, hugs and rewards and trophies and fucking, like, you know, free Under Armour shirts. You know what I'm saying? Like, he don't get that shit. But that example of the police department's sort of coordination against, I mean, part of it, I think, is their culture against knowledge coming about out in general. So I just finished this story that's out right now in City Paper that's 10,000 words that I worked on for a year and a half investigating the death of Tyree Woodson in 2014. And the guy who they allowed to write the account of his death was not allowed to testify in a trial against the same person, Woodson, 3 months earlier because the state's attorney's office had questions with his integrity. He's not allowed to testify because they were investigating his integrity. He was in jail a year and a half on this. All charges were dropped. He was cleared of everything. And then 3 months later, the guy ends up dead in the bathroom of the precinct. And no one thinks twice about it, that the person, the only person who writes an account of what happened that day is the same guy who had been accused of falsifying charges against him and wasn't allowed to testify 3 months earlier. And like that kind of, if it's negligence is so profound that it's almost worse than concerted evil, that you just don't care enough about someone's life to even investigate it at all. And in a week after the death, they wrote to the guy who moved the gun out of the way that killed him. And they said, oh, what did you do with the gloves that you used to move that gun? And he's like, I threw it in the trash can. And the trash can was never secured. They just emptied the trash that day like they would any other day. Like there was no secured crime scene.
So for this system to function properly, the people in media and the police officers, these two major groups, would have to see some type of value in black people, poor black people in particular, black people without some of the resources that other people have. They would have to see value in that. And they just don't. And they prove it every day. Like, they prove it. Oh, they're so good at proving it. Like, it's like when I hear things like, well, this person may have lied, or this person was negligent, or this person, you know, with, you know, when you say it's deep and it's crazy, it's really not. Like, we just look at all this stuff you guys found. You guys did brilliant work and you found all of these things on one case. But look how many cases are out there. Like, there's so many. Like, I've seen some, like, coming up in this town, I saw some weirdo shit. Like, you get locked up for 2 months, but you get like 200 years of probation over top of your head. Like, it's like the system, they just fucking do anything. Like, it's, I don't know, it's all cowboys.
And really, I mean, if you go, one of the most tragic things is sitting in reception court and you just see like a whole day worth of black men coming in shackles, being told, oh, you don't get it set for a trial date yet, send back to jail. And then half the time those cases will be null prost when they get to court, and they never, I mean, we have these officers that are able to, I mean, in the case of Tyree Woodson, it was these extreme charges, so he couldn't get bail, so they just keep him in for a year and a half.
But who's telling the story? So the story of the police officer, and Aaron, you can jump in whenever you want to, the story of this police officer is, of the police officer in this country is, like we said in the previous episode, it's a noble person who really wants to protect and really wants to make a difference, who puts his or her life on a line to protect the people, and you gotta respect that. That's always the story that's being pushed forward. So it's not strange for a white person who's never had these experiences for that to be part of their belief system, or a black person who's had some pretty good experiences from a pretty good neighborhood to think favorably of a cop, because that's the nerd. When you look at movies, fucking Mel Gibson and Danny Glover and shit, like, you know, these guys are good people. Like, they put it all on the line for us. But then when you look at real life, it's like the biggest lie. It's the fucking lie. And it all goes back into who's telling that story, who's promoting that story. So if the son and the police department had some type of relationship, it's not strange for story after story. That's why I was so like in awe and amazed when Pute's story came out about the amount of money we spend. That shit was like I was like, yo, damn. So we pay their salary, we pay their vacation, and there's another $6 million on top of that, not counting the money. Like, this is like crazy.
I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind here, especially when we have conversations about the police, is that generally the police enjoy very broad positive public support. The most recent polling shows that most people have a great deal, quote unquote, great deal of respect for police officers. So that's number one. And number two, in this discussion about who puts out certain information that would obviously demean the victim and make the cops look better, it is in the law enforcement community's interest to put this information out there. And this is not my opinion. This is because our laws are such, and our Constitution has been interpreted in a way that tips the scales in favor of law enforcement every time in these cases. So if all you need to do as a police officer, whether it's in a shooting or misconduct or excessive force case, if all you need to do is say, I feared for my life, or I didn't see any other way to force compliance except use this amount of force, then you're able to get off scot-free. That's the way our system is set up. And again, I don't share that as my opinion. I believe that to be truth. Until we challenge some of the standards and guidelines that really sort of dictate the way juries are allowed to deliberate about police excessive force and lethal force cases, I mean, we're going to see this over and over and over again. So I think we just need to keep those things in mind whenever we're having these discussions. On top of that, when a cop shoots a black person, magically, all this money starts pouring in for their defense. So all those three things, I think, really have really been on my mind.
Racist magic.
Right. This is what happened with Betty Shelby in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tons of money poured in for her defense. Her defense team sent her out to 60 Minutes and on television and in newspapers, whoever listened to her, to tell a counter narrative to the video that everyone got to see, the video that everyone got to hear someone say, oh, he looks like a bad dude. Like, we see all that. And then people hear the not guilty verdict and they're like, how? I was like, well, look at our laws. Look at the standards that we have for use of force. Look at
how she get to go back to work.
Police, exactly. She is back to work.
And back pay probably too, like $100,000. Me getting wicked on my side of town. Since the early 80s, it's been going down. Hitting blocks with the guns that make the hell
helicopter sound, homicide detective chalking up 150 rounds.
So one of the happiest days of my life, and I've been a big Obama critic, but I felt like out of every president, this was like the one that, like, you know, ideologies was as close as to mine. So when I got a chance to go and meet the president with like 150 other people to talk about some of these issues, I got that phone call for A, B, and C. I was on a train, like with my head in the clouds, like, yo, this is crazy. Like, I can't believe, like, I'm going to get a chance to meet the president. And, I didn't get to meet him for real, but we were really close. Like, he was like, I was close enough that like, I could have, you remember, I was about as close as the guy that threw the shoe at George Bush. So I was like that close. I was like that close, but I wanna throw a shoe at Barack Obama. But as I was listening, this is right after the Dallas shooting. So I'm listening to him talk, and he's like, you know, we can't prosecute, it's almost hard to convict police. We can't prosecute them and arrest them. We need them to protect us. And I was like, damn. So if he's saying that, you know, and I don't know what type of political thing it was tied to or whatever. I don't really make excuses for nobody. And I didn't expect him to be radical and say something like, yo, the reason why these police officers were shot in Dallas is because how all of these things, it's a reflection of what's happening in the country. You know, this is a very, very angry and hurt person who did this. Like, it's not like a random thing. Like, he didn't randomly go out there and do this. And, you know, to not even address just totally gloss over everything else that was going on in the country and say that, and you're Barack Obama, I'm like, damn, what the fuck is Jeff Sessions thinking? He's like, so like, what the fuck would Donald Trump say? Like, they somewhere like, yeah, you know, let's just, if we move this page to that page and we go back and, you know, we photocopy and then retype the Constitution and rewrite it, you know, maybe we can try to reinstate slavery. Like, what the fuck are they thinking? Like, seriously.
I wanted to say something touching on what Aaron was saying, because there's this thing of storytelling, which is what police officers do. They arrest someone or they shoot someone, and then they sit down and they write these reports. And a lot of times their reports have this kind of language. Based on my training and experience, I believed he was holding a gun. There was a bulge, or the way he walked, or the way he opened the car door. So the storytelling starts really, really early. And like going back through the Freddie Gray narratives, we see the story about him banging his head develop on day one. Came from probably Officer Novak, who fed it to Dante Allen. Dante Allen gave it in an interview, showed up in the reports that night. A year later, that story hasn't gone away. It shows up in media. So that's sort of this, I wonder if there would be anything that could be done about that, like a different way of policing that doesn't give them so much power to basically just write what they think happened. And then there's evidence that the courts favor those narratives.
But if they don't write it, then their friends are. Look at what happened in Walter Scott case. And, you know, he wrote that pack of lies, and then his friend walked right over there and, like, corroborated that story. And I don't even hear his name coming up in the media. He straight lied. He doesn't even get talked about. The cop that was with him at when Walter, he walked right over and I said, yeah, this is what happened. Right.
And if they're involved here in Maryland, like Aaron was saying about the kind of extra protections they have, they don't have to give a statement for 10 days at all because of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights. And then very often that'll be 4 months, 5 months, 6 months before they ever give a statement. Yeah. And then they're all able to give virtually identical statements.
Yeah. I mean, fortunately, in this case, we could see how the statements evolved. Like, they came up with stuff later that showed up in court. And I mean, honestly, that's a failure of the state's attorney's office to not, you know, prosecute them for changing their story, basically.
Speaking of leaks, one of the weird sort of potentially tragic misses on this is came out through. So to the entire state's attorney's office was leaked all of the text messages and emails purporting to be from Bledsoe and lead investigator Danielle Taylor. And so when you read those, you see how difficult it was for the state's attorney's office to try to get the personal cell phones. And so we never know what happened on the personal cell phones of those officers, what kind of calls they had with each other that day, what sort of communications they had that day. And had we been able to know that, I think we would have known a lot more, because they were out, they all live in the county. None of them lived in the city. So the search warrant for the city wasn't valid for the county, and they were never able to do it.
But they could have. Like, if the cop, Danielle Taylor, was really interested, she could have just said, hey, we got the wrong, let's fix it, you know?
Totally.
Yeah.
She's gone now, right?
She's in jail, or she was arrested for, I don't know what's happened to her. Do you know?
She's on administrative leave, I think. And she was charged with domestic abuse. I mean, her situation is crazy, too, because she's been in the center of so much news. She was the one person that she hit a dirt bike rider. She got beat up by another dirt bike rider. And then they used the surveillance plane that was secretly surveilling us for months without anyone knowing to track that guy. One of the guys she hit to his house and arrest him. All he did was get hit by a car riding a dirt bike.
Do we know that she actually got beat up by dirt bike? That was her story, right?
Yeah, that was, and they charged.
Was that on the camera?
So that wasn't on the...
Did we see that?
Yeah,
did we ever see
so
that?
It's interesting. They've never provided that.
That phone had those messages.
Yeah.
So she could have, you know, honorably brought something to the table that wasn't there. But again, it's not we. It's us versus them. Like, it's us versus them, us versus them, us versus them. And that's why I'm saying, like, it's hard for me to consider, like, you know, even just the idea, like, well, you know, all cops, there's some good cops out there. It's like, okay, where they at, though? Like...
Well, a lot of them leave, or they just...
They're not cops no more then.
Or they get if they're really good cops and they really speak up, they get put on bad assignments, you know?
It's like Walmart duty. It was a bad assignment. I hate Walmart. I felt like Walmart duty was like a bad assignment.
What could be done to limit... Like, I'm going back to this idea of storytelling. Like, it would take the media to really be like, we're going to put a moratorium on just accepting cops. I mean, that's the thing. It's sort of like, what is this idea of news? Like, just because you hear something from a government official, that has to be the 6 o'clock news?
Yes.
No, you know, to be honest with you, I go out of my way every time I write a story about one of these cases or about anything that's going on, any ongoing movement. I want the reader to know what the government agency is saying about this, but then I also want to make sure that they know what the activist is saying about this, what the community members are saying about this. That's just as important. That has just as much weight as the government agency. But I think what the issue that you might be sort of approaching here, Justin, is this idea that too few reporters challenge the narrative that government agencies are putting out. So in police departments, you know, in particular, we need to see more, like just a couple of graphs, I think is all it takes for you to just to stick it in the story and say, yeah, the cops said this, but upon multiple interviews with people in the community and with activists who were on the scene or who witnessed, they say this, that's complete bullshit, that did not happen the way the cops say it happened. But I don't see that enough in stories.
With some of these, when they release CCTV video, you know, where's the rest of it? Where's the before and after? When they chased that kid in Baltimore and he turned around for a second and waved his gun and then he got shot. Do you remember his name, anyone?
His last name is Curtis.
So, okay. I get, like, all of the cops that I follow are saying this is a clean shooting, even the reform-minded ones. Maybe. But, like, where's the before? I need to see the whole video. You know, that's another part of it. There's so many things that could be questioned when you get one piece of information from police, and that just never happens.
I mean, and we see this, I mean, Dee, we've been working on the case with Baltimore rapper Young Moose and his sort of being tormented for months and months by a Detective Herschel, and everything that no one would believe what Moose and his family was saying, all of whom had been arrested by the same officer. He keeps coming over to our store, robbing us, stealing money from the store. We'd been reporting on it for a long time. Then he gets arrested. The officer finally gets federal indictment for doing all of those things. And yet we still don't tend to say, oh, we're going to believe. I mean, we should at least be believing Moose every bit as much as we're believing Herschel. But there's still numerous reports that just will say the police report when it's a guy who... You know, and one of his colleagues in that, the seven officers were indicted, is now making the claim that he should not be held without bail because everyone in the department is so corrupt that his that his own behavior his was the same training as everyone else's. So why hold him?
And it's just sort of the Freddie Gray argument. Yeah. You know, we all don't seatbelt. We all believe in jailitis.
Our training's so bad that, and our instructions are so bad that you can't blame me. You have to blame the department.
My training's so bad that fuck humanity. It just doesn't exist. Like, this is how bad my training is. Like, I might slap you because I'm not trained, because I don't really know how to do basic shit. That's what I'm saying. That's why even like in exploring all of these situations and speaking with all these hypotheticals, we would have to assume that these people actually gave a fuck about the people they're supposed to be working for, and they just don't.
And the, when you were talking about like which story you're believing, in the case files, the notes written up about the officers are a page and a half, and the notes written up about Harold Perry, who was on here, he got like four bullet points. And he was, how much of a story? He was by himself on here with you and Amelia, and he talked for over an hour. And we interviewed him for over an hour. And he remembered so much to the point where Amelia is obsessed with Lieutenant Whiteshirt. Because, you know, like, so it's all happening on day one. It happens on day one, whatever the event is. Cops come up with their narrative or within that first week. and you just follow it to the investigators, to the state's attorney's office, to the media, and it's the same story. It might change to cover up mistakes, but they come up with it really quickly, you know?
Yeah, so for me, like, I feel like podcasts like this help, and I feel like, you know, us still doing the work or trying to be some of the few people to actually talk about these things and write about these things helps, but especially once your perspective on this, Aaron, it's like, what do you think we all could be doing to be the ones more in control of the narrative that's out there? Because right now, some of these major publications, they just, you know, they put out a story and it just becomes the standard. Everyone accepts it, and it further allows the dehumanization of Black people and poor people to continue.
So let me first say, I come from a background where I was a local newspaper reporter. That's how I started. I was an intern, you know, at a local newspaper. And then, you know, my first job was in covering local municipal goings on. So I very much like have a lot of respect for the work that folks, you know, like Baynard and Justine have, you know, what you're doing in that community and unearthing these stories and talking to the families and getting this information into publication so that folks like me in New York City, who, you know, I'm looking for additional information, if you all are putting out nuanced narratives, nuanced depictions and really a look at the community, then I don't just have this statement from the police department. That's easy to find. I can just sometimes, depending on how technologically savvy a police department is, I can usually find whatever statement they put out. But it's harder to find when you're not there in the community. It's harder to find and cover these cases and write about these cases and give people who had never been to Baltimore a real sense of what this means to the community. Who was touched by this incident? And so I wouldn't say I put pressure on local reporters, but I certainly rely on local reporters to do some of that groundwork and make sure enough of that sort of bubbles up to the surface so that when national, you know, folks like the Washington Post, well, the Washington Post maybe is not that good of an example because, you know, they're just in D.C. They have a bureau and or at least a few reporters who report in Baltimore. But, you know, the New York Times and USA Today and, you know, any of the other big institutions, you know, I believe that they really look at, OK, what has the local reporter said about this case? Has the local reporter found the family? Has the local reporter reported on the background of this young man? Not his or her criminal background, but what school did they go to? Did they play baseball in Little League? You know, these little details are important to telling stories about human beings and not just shooting victims. So I think to answer your question, long-winded way of answering your question, we definitely need more of that nuanced narrative. The way to inject humanity back into a lot of these stories is to cover the people who were impacted by this incident, and not just the police, not just the civil unrest, not just the protest, but the folks. Cover the neighborhood folks, and I think that will help to balance out what sometimes is such bad information coming out of law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, I really agree with that. And one of the problems, I think, with the ability to cover really complex cases is, like, you know, from 1990 to now, we've lost 200,000 reporter jobs nationally. So there's so many fewer of us than there ever were. And so it just makes corruption on the local level be so much easier to get away with for them and so much more rampant. And it's valuable for a news organization if you do have someone who's down with the cops, if you also have someone who's down with other kinds of people, and you can compare those stories and you can bounce it off of each other and stuff. But when you only have one or the other, when you have so many fewer people, but whenever something happens, if you find there's always local reporters there that I do think give that kind of nuance that's important to get.
Sort of touching on what you're saying, but just let's go back to April 30th, all right? Okay, so there's the story about the bolt that you guys heard, right? The original story had a video of, what is this guy's name? I want to say like Brett Barr or Burt B or something like that. He was out of a WJLA DC. And the original video of him saying, this is the big discovery of the investigation, he hit his head against a bolt, was on the webpage about 5 days ago. And I don't know if this is a coincidence. Maybe you can tell me. I think it must be a coincidence, but I started to, in preparation for writing, I was putting out a lot of questions to a lot of media about that story. That video is not there anymore, so I don't know what's up with that. But we tracked down that you can see the original news reports on this webpage where you can actually go through the whole day of news. You know this? So this is April 30th. This is what happened. This same guy, he at 7 o'clock in the morning reported that another prisoner heard Freddie Gray banging his head against the wall. 7 o'clock in the morning, he's standing there saying that. At noon, he says he's got special information that there was a third stop, and at that third stop, Freddie Gray is still seen alive. All right, those two go together. Around 4 o'clock, Dante Allen comes out on TV and says that he never said that Freddie Gray injured himself. Then that same day, that night, he's reporting on the Bolt. Do you see how that works? Like, that is a crazy day of reporting. And that is one person who calls himself a reporter. How, as a reporter, would you be able to take in that much information every few hours, go out there and give a different story and not say, wait a minute? You know what I mean? And I don't know why the hell that story did. Do you think that it's possible? I'm asking you as a journalist, that me asking around about that story could have caused the video to disappear. I've gotten a little paranoid, you know?
I mean, I don't know anything about the way the TV stations work. And I know that we've had, you know, I think of TV as much different, where there's not the same kind of care often. So this case that I was just talking about, Tyree Woodson, they said he killed himself by smuggling a gun into the police station in a medical boot. And the police used the word boot in their report. And so then on the same station as Miller on BAL, someone comes in and holds up this giant plastic boot that's knee high and says, it's like this. And then when I see the crime scene photos, it's a strap-on medical shoe that's low top with exposed toe.
And you can't get a gun in there.
I actually bought the boot and got a gun, or the shoe, and got the exact gun, and you can fit it in, sort of, but there's no way you could be searched. But the idea was, if it was this big knee-high thing, no way anyone could feel it in there, and
where
you could smuggle it in.
Where are they getting that from?
And so I asked the reporter,
they as they go.
And they couldn't give a
right,
comment.
Right, no comments. Yeah. No comments from media.
I think it's a bad game of, in a lot of ways, a bad game of telephone. And, you know, sometimes I'm very concerned, especially it being in New York City and writing about these things and by, you know, relying some on original reporting, calling people who I know in the community, and then also looking at local news clippings. I worry about that. Am I passing along information that really isn't that solid? And so often, if a case is big enough, certainly Freddie Gray was big from the get-go, then I'm asking my news organization, hey, you mind sending me there so that everything that I report is something that I stand behind 100% and I'm not, you know, only relying on the work of folks who've already been in the community but still can make mistakes, still can take information and sort of twist it or misinterpret it. And then it's funny, though, to your point, Justine, that that's the information that does bubble up to the surface and sort of become part of the national narrative around some of these cases, where I don't remember hearing about the boot in the national, coverage of the Bolt. That's what I meant, the Bolt. But in this case, it could have been a boot.
Right,
too.
Right.
I mean, the thing is, if it was the boot and that made it to the national conversation, who's there to correct that at the New York Times or the USA Today and say, well, actually, we need to, you know, issue a correction or a clarification and let people know that this was actually based on faulty information.
There's so little skepticism around this case, which I don't get, because I feel like mainstream media, like I see it, the Times and the Washington Post, they can be really skeptical about information. But with this case, they just sort of ate it up and spit it back out. And I don't entirely understand it.
Even though we all know that he didn't kill himself, it's like all of these technicalities, it's just like people don't care about people. Like,
I like the City Papers, like the headline about Dante Allen. It was really the only, I don't remember what it was, but it sort of was like, well, this story has come out about him bashing his own head against the wall. And you were sort of like, well, even the headline said this contradicts previous information. It was very refreshing. And then the other one was the van sign. Do you remember this story?
Yeah.
Somebody on Facebook, which is now the new place to pretend that you're just innocently posting things, posted a picture of a sign inside of a van saying, enjoy the ride, because we sure will. And I had not been able to let that go. I had thought there's something off about this because they're trying to push a Rough Ride narrative. And I just don't know if this is real. And then you guys had done sort of a, you know, you said it might not be real. And then to think about how police are, this was an art student who posted it, that's possibly happening now, that social media is being used as this kind of like, this is just people talking, you know, and they might, this is the actual truth, whereas it might have been a complete manipulation. I'm not sure, but I appreciated that you guys were approaching the few things that you took about the actual case itself that wasn't the protests, you approached with sort of a healthy skepticism, which is so unusual, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting since we're talking sort of about fake news. The other thing we haven't talked about yet that is the credible threat to police officers and the purge and all of this stuff, which is now in the convergence of fake news worlds, there's this whole thing going around Baltimore where people are saying the Russians did that.
Blood and Crip truce.
Yeah.
And we're going to get together and hurt police officers.
No, I mean, what's crazy about that is that there really, I mean, I have on video and saw and we published that there really was on the barricades on that Wednesday, there really was standing up who said, you know, hey, we're going to get together and kill these bitches. You know, 276, I'm BGF, we're going to, and so there was a threat that was directed right in front of them that I know they saw. And I think that's what they based it on. But it wasn't a credible threat. It's what the FBI said. Like, this is a guy who's, like, standing up kind of drunk on the barricades yelling and trying to seem really cool. And he turns out to be the same guy. He was at a number of different points as things happened. But so there was a threat that then the police released, saved and released at a really weird time.
After the funeral.
During the funeral, yeah. And then allowing that to use them with the purge to like force the kids out and trap them at Mondawmin, which is really like.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
It's really top of the line smart policing.
I mean, to even call it a riot, it's like actually they were.
LA had a riot. This wasn't a riot.
This was kids trapped. This wasn't a riot. Trapped with no place to go.
How many people died in this riot?
I don't know.
Zero.
Yeah, zero.
I think like a cop got hit in the face with like a rock who had a helmet on.
Right, and civilians got hurt too, yeah.
Yeah, but how many people died in LA riots? People died in LA riots.
Or here in 68. I mean, over 100 people died in Baltimore in 68.
That's sort of the recipe to have for a police commissioner to create a riot if he thinks he needs a riot so that he can enforce a curfew. I'm not saying that that is exactly what was going on, but there's the recipe for it. You know, keep people in a certain place, have all the cops around in riot gear.
That's what I'm saying. Who's telling the story and what they're putting out there and how they have the luxury of framing us however they want to frame us. Like, they can say whatever they want to say about us, and people are going to take their word 110% of the time, and it's like nothing. It's nothing we can do about it. And then when we walk around like we have no faith, people look at us like we crazy. Like, yo, y'all crazy. Like, y'all, like, nah, you gotta, you know, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and, you know, you stand in English and the whole world would be okay. And it's like, it's really fucked. Like, it's really messed up. Like, I know it, like, it sounds like we're just talking and we're having a good time. But when I say I really will never call a police officer, like, I will never call them, like, unless it's so I can try to get some back. And then I'm not even, if somebody broke in my house, my insurance company tried out, like, I was making it up. I'm like, yo, like, like, I don't got time for this shit. Like, I don't got time to call you up and get receipts. And you don't got time to go to Towson and get a receipt for a fucking watch. Like, I don't got time for that shit. Like, so it's all like this red game. It's just, it's a whole different universe. Like, it's a whole world that is like, you know, me as a successful person or unsuccessful person, whatever I am, the different phases of my life is some shit that I just don't got time to subscribe to. Like, I just don't. So I'm not the best person to even like report on police or anything, because when I see them, I'm like, oh my God, man, this fucking like asshole. Like, even when I see the videos of them like playing basketball with kids, I'm like, photo op. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't, you know, because I'm looking at the big result. Like, what is Dante Allen? Like, what really happened with Dante Allen? What did the cards hold for him? He was fucked if he did or he didn't. He didn't have a way out. Either way, your shit is done. And that's probably why Don Y'all might be gone. Maybe she knew too much. All that shit was kind of weird, how you go from hero to zero, like hero to gone, because they protect their own. I know plenty of police dudes. Let me go back. I know two. I know two, not plenty. I don't want to be Russian news
plenty,
guy.
Yeah.
I know two. I know two dudes for sure. One of them I went to high school with. Definitely went down for domestics and ain't really go to jail. They beat girls up that I know. They didn't go to jail. they look out for each other. When you're in there, you're in there. It's the biggest gang in the world.
That's what I've heard. It's very Sopranos. It's like when you're in, you are very in. So how does somebody when they decide you're out.
So when she got that cell phone and nobody can get to that cell phone, that's a hero, right? Because that shit had the truth. Any information that we can't get. But when she goes out for a domestic, she actually goes inside of a jail. When you got these people that just, you know, quote unquote, participated in the killing of this young man who wasn't in jail long enough to even, you know, but so this civilian life matters more than another civilian life. It's all rigged. Like, it's all rigged. And until we acknowledge that, as people that got to look at it like that, until we acknowledge that, we'll never be happy. We'll never work towards being free. We'll never really be able to do anything until we sit back and acknowledge, like, yo, these people, it's in their self-interest to not fuck with us. It's in the self-interest of this country for them to act like that, because it's the best way to maintain these different power structures. You don't go against self-interest. It's just, you just don't. I'm gonna probably end up in the jailhouse with them. They gonna have to lock
me in a maximum prison before I let it. The deep segregation of Baltimore that's so severely segregated that, you know, being a white guy in Baltimore, you really don't, unless you go out of your way to see the way that Black Baltimore is policed and how different, I mean, the police in many ways, the purpose of the police in Baltimore is to maintain that segregation. It's in almost an apartheid way to keep that segregation there and to keep white people from seeing what Black Baltimore is like and what policing in Black Baltimore is like. And when you first start to see that and pay attention, it really, but it's against your self-interest. If you're living in Hamden or wherever you're living, like, you don't want to see that the police are there to protect your property. And that's essentially it.
It's an ugly mirror, you know? You don't want to see that shit. You want to get a latte and go jogging, you know? White people fucking love to jog. You want to go jogging, you know what I'm saying? You don't want to see that shit. I know that shit is real. And I've seen multiple sides of Baltimore. Like I said, I've seen multiple sides. I thought it was two Baltimore. It's like fucking six of them. Like, I'm seeing different people on different waves that float, like, that move in a different way. Like, I'm seeing it, and it only reinforces everything that everybody my whole life been telling me. It just reinforces it, like, you know. And again, it's not about anything outside of self-interest. You're not going to go against it.
One of the things, or at least something that I've always thought about, is that where is the incentive for police officers, police departments in general, to want to improve this relationship when they know that most often, if they've done something wrong, if it's misconduct, if it's manslaughter, if it's even allegedly murder, they know that their misconduct, their manslaughter, their alleged murder is not going to be treated the same as that same behavior from you or I. They know that. So where is the incentive for them to be better? If the law is written in such a way and interpreted in such a way that the scale will never be balanced until that changes. I hear your frustration, Dee, but I think that's really where it starts, is this idea that you join the force and you are now completely living in a different world, an alternate world where the same laws that everybody else must abide, they don't actually all the way apply to you.
Yeah, I mean, like, Joe Crystal here was a good example, who witnessed police, his fellow, it was a police officer, and witnessed other cops go and beat someone up. When he told the department what had happened, you know, people stopped answering his calls for backup and stuff. And then this guy's like on the line, his life is on the line. And so he has to leave the department. And that kind of thing, it disincentivizes doing the right thing while incentivizes being one of the gang and just like keeping your mouth shut.
And, you know, with the Freddie Gray case, there were a few younger cops who were at the scene, Gladhill, Wood, Alvarado, I think. At least two of them have left the department since. A lot of people, we could fill a page with people who left the department or were thrown out or pushed out after Freddie Gray. But, you know, just imagine being like a 22-year-old cop, and this is your first year on the force, and you're thrown in the middle of this. You're told to lie in court. You know, that van wasn't shaking and nobody saw it shaking. And then you're wrapped up in just this off. They moved to the suburbs. They moved to police departments in the suburbs, you know?
You can just move a 6,000-pound van.
back and forth.
At 125 pounds.
I don't know. I haven't seen Danielle Taylor's video. I've heard it. That apparent. Were you in court when they showed it?
So, numerous times, unfortunately. Okay.
Right. So how did it look to you? Did it look like, okay, Freddie Gray shackled with his hands and his legs would have been able to shake the van back and forth for minutes?
I mean, he didn't do it for minutes
right. In
the tape, as far as I can recall. And so, I mean, but it was shaking a little bit. But it was not a thing. I don't think it was a thing. And again, it's hard to tell from a video because you're not far away.
Right.
I don't think it would be a thing you could tell. I mean, if you're like they say, writing your paperwork on the back of the van, you could tell if it was, I think, from what was happening in the video. But if you were pulling up in your car, you know, you're not going to be able to tell that van's shaking. It's not like a comedy movie where people are having sex in a van and the thing's moving back and forth wildly or something. It's barely sort of moving a little bit.
Right. They all said it was going back and forth for minutes. And, you know, this is after we see him on the video kind of like prone and put in the van.
Again, you know, you get the opportunity to kind of create these things as you go. Like, it's the society that rewards that. You know, if people have gotten book deals and all the other types of things where they just, you get to just punch these things in as you go.
Yeah, I mean, we're still at a place with this city where, I mean, we just, there's the case right now where Kevin Deutsch's book, Pill City, about, you know, alleging that this high school kids created this national crime syndicate by using an app. And it's been really deeply questioned by numerous people. And he's never been able to... People I've talked to, no one knows any of these people who are supposedly well documented. And it's amazing how many people just buy that story. How many people, without asking, that book publishers don't do fact checking, and that, like, you have an entire book that seems very questionable that major publications give these glowing reviews to without ever asking, like, is that plausible at all? And it's a weird thing about this city seeming so distant to most of the rest of the country, I feel like, and yet right here, but like something they did. Oh yeah, we'll believe that. It's
Baltimore, man. When I'm out of town, I tell people, when people know I'm from Baltimore, when they ask me, where you from? And I say Baltimore, they be like, ew.
So, but, you know, so many...
Baltimore's a beautiful place.
Thank you, Aaron.
I love Baltimore.
Thank you.
So many, so many crime stories out of here than, like, you know, Philly. More than, I mean, maybe New York compares, but I mean, Baltimore's not that huge. Just the amount of crime stories out of Baltimore. I don't know if David Simon kicked it off and made it like a cool place to look at crime. I think that the department is just really that corrupt is one reason. I'm not saying
this is a city where a known drug dealer paid police officers to go pick people up off the street and bring them to him so he can kill them. This is here. That was Anthony Jones. None of this stuff makes it into these conversations. Like I said, the idea of, you know, and I don't know what they're doing now. I don't follow police. I don't report on them. I don't blog. I don't know them. I don't really know police officers that work in Baltimore City. Like, I don't know what their move is. But then you have the cops walking around with the Freddie Gray 6-0 t-shirts, you know? Like, come on. Like, you know, that wasn't Photoshopped by our student. That's how they feel. We beat them. We beat them. Us against them, you know, as if none of us pay taxes, as if none of us pay their salaries, as if we don't got to pay, you know, as if we're not citizens who work and are productive. Like, all of us are these fucked up things. So when we say all of them are fucked up, then it's like all cops aren't bad. But I never heard a police officer, or I don't hear police officers, or too many police officers, except for the resident community liaison people jump out and say, oh, all these people that, you know, are saying these stories about us, you know, like it's not like a true thing, like, you know, like it's not a two-way street.
Watch out for resident community liaisons. I found a video of Officer Novak. I don't know if you've been following the story. Novak is, well, you know, the Novak is the one who got away, who was made primary officer, even though he's a witness, and he's really behind a lot of the Dante Allen stuff and everything. He was online being a community liaison, and wow, did he talk up a good game. I mean, I would have been like, oh, these officers are good people.
Now, I do want to say that having a good officer in one of those in a position can make a huge difference. So there's a big standoff with the police here. After the rapper Lor Scooter was murdered, there was a vigil, people were grieving, and the police mounted up in riot gear and started moving in, and it was really tense again. And There's one lieutenant, a white shirt, who comes out to protest, and whenever he's there, things go bad. Thompson. And it's always going to be someone will get arrested. There will be some kind of, it will escalate. His role is he escalates. And there's another one, Shorter, and not coincidentally, probably Thompson's white and Shorter's black. But Shorter will almost always, so he came in and took over from Thompson and went up and started meeting with community people, and they negotiated backing the cops up. And I mean, he kept that from being a thing where people would have gotten hurt to where people didn't get hurt. And, you know, but he's got zero incentive to, no one supports him for doing that, I feel like, within the department.
Right.
That's not, I mean, I don't know that for a fact. I don't know their internal working, so I shouldn't say that. But like, he doesn't seem to be in any way rewarded more than Thompson, who it seems like is always there when things are escalated.
No, the arrests are the thing that mostly gets awarded, so.
But there's hope. There's hope. There's hope. You know, there's hope.
Can I ask this? How much hope does the local community have around sort of this right under the gun DOJ consent decree that's been, you know, put in place to help reform?
So there's like a progressive Negro population here, and they always have hope. And then there's like, you know, like, fuck, I forget that I'm progressive. I guess I am progressive. I really don't have no hope, though. Like, the people who people who I interact with the most, it doesn't feel like anything. Like, the DOJ is not even, like, a real thing. Like, it is a real thing to, if I'm doing media stuff and I'm reporting and I'm writing and I'm trying to put these stories together, then it's a real thing. It must be considered. Like, you know, there's a lot went into that. But then when I've just, like, if I'm talking to, like, one of the students at the high schools who I mentor, it's like, you know, what's a DOJ? Like, it's like DOJ. Like, what is, they don't have any faith. They don't think that, you know, kids are still being raised. The tradition is still the same. Freddie Gray is still a person. Their perspective, Freddie Gray is still a person that was murdered in their eyes. In their eyes, he was murdered. In their eyes, charging the police was like something that nobody thought could ever happen. But, you know, actually sending them to jail. The activist community still, you know, they still fight the system and they go against the system. And they still, you know, different activists still do different things as far as like in line with what they've been doing even before Freddie Gray happened. But the average Baltimore resident walking up and down West Baltimore, East Baltimore, or MR, Diamond Mall, Miami Street somewhere, they not just don't even make it into the conversation. And they don't think police reform is a real thing. Like, it's impossible. And that energy comes from the long history of dehumanizing black people that has just been, like, you know, woven into the fabric of policing in these communities. Like, it's not. It would be like me taking $10 from you, putting it in my pocket and pulling like $50 million out. Like, it's just not going to happen. You know, it's not a real thing. It's like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy. You know, like, these things just don't exist.
Well, there's been like 10 years of policy-based reforms in Baltimore. The consent decree is just a part of that tradition. I don't know if policy-based reforms work at all.
And a lot of other things that have happened since the DOJ report. And I mean, and that report was so damning. It did more to take away faith from the people that it was changeable, I think, than that it would change. But then we find out that there was this secret spying program where they're flying and they're able to record 32 square miles and go forward and backward in time, and didn't think they needed to tell even city officials that was happening. And then, of course, we get Jeff Sessions in charge of the DOJ now, and right before the consent decree is supposed to come through, saying, oh, we want to back out on this, I think was intended to destroy any faith that anyone had in the DOJ, you know.
In theory, it should, just to answer the question one more time, or to circle back, in theory, it should give us hope and faith as like a push towards reform happening. But that's just a theory. In real life, them shits never materialized. Like, this isn't the first time the DOJs came into a city. Obviously, you know, and this probably won't be the last. And, you know, if you are a person with limited opportunity from a culture of limited opportunity, then you're going to get caught up in the same type of things. And it's really nothing you can really do about it. It's like this. It's like the shit is already stacked up against you before you even get started. Like, in everything from the food you eat to the books you're given to read to the way your school look to your family legacy. Like, all of this shit is just stacked around you. And most of us, like, I know for me personally, like, I didn't even know how fucked up my reality was until like I turned like 20 something. I'm not even talking about a kid. Like, I'm in my 20s. Like, yo, god damn. 4 miles, 5 miles to get an apple? police don't treat everybody like this? What the fuck? It's places that just got Wi-Fi in the whole neighborhood. Like, all of this shit is like new shit. It's like new stuff. So a lot of people don't even know how stacked up it is against them. So it's easy for me to say half the people, we can go in certain neighborhoods. I can take you to certain neighborhoods right now in Baltimore. We can talk to random people about the DOJ and about police reform. And they're going to be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Shit, I can take you to neighborhoods in Baltimore where people don't even know what Black Lives Matter is. They don't even know what it is. They're going to be like, what's that? And I'm like, yo, it's a hashtag. It's an organization. These women set it up and yada, yada, yada. They're like, damn, for real? Oh, okay. You know, it's like new information. Like, it's like a new thing.
But also, it's like, what are you going to trust in the hands of people like Kevin Davis and Dean Palmer and Stanley Branford who are running? I mean, you know, what our case hopefully did was shed some light on how insidiously they operate and how little regard they have for the quality of life of the citizens. So you could hand them all of the most important best practice policies in the world. I mean, you would certainly need more honest leaders, in my personal opinion, to implement them.
The union is also such a problem. I mean, and it's weird that it's police almost, or police chiefs are commissioners are some of the only people who are left to deal with a union that is as powerful as they are. The only bosses left in America, and it's this real right-wing reactionary force that really protects officers. I mean, we had 2 days ago, someone was shot by police. The Baltimore Block, the activist group that really does a lot on police accountability, was out filming it. And one of the lieutenants comes up and body slams him to the ground, then arrests him and charges him, keeps him in overnight. Now, certainly the charges against him will be dropped, I imagine.
I mean, you had a whole summer or fall of I'm sorry to bring up President Trump again, but you had a whole fall of President Trump or then candidate Trump advocating violence against people who dissent against the majority, so to speak, at his rallies. So I don't know. I'm not saying I know this to be fact, but maybe some of this violence towards, you know, reporters and to, you know, citizens standing, on the sidewalk recording a police interaction, maybe some of that has been inspired by this sort of different environment that we are sort of living in now, where what we thought was not tolerated before is now, you know, sort of comes as second nature to police officers or to politicians.
I'm Donald Trump. I would love police. They fucking risk their life to make sure he's like is okay. Like, he should be 100%. That's why I'm saying this off perspective. Like, if police officers really, really like you and like they see you and they instantly think human being, person, citizen, then yeah, you should rock with them. Like, they on your side. But like, if you know they look at you and they think criminal, bastard, asshole, horrible person, then your whole action or how you treat them is going to be completely different. Like, I understand why people be like, yo, you know, our cops are this, or yo, police officers this, or police officer. I understand that because it's all perspective. Like, it's so Trump should, Jeff Sessions, I mean, you know, he looks like the poster child for a thing that a police officer, a little elf that a police officer would want to protect. You know, I'm going to protect this elf. So, like an elf.
I have a friend who's a cop, and, you know, I'd been talking to him about writing with him. And I said, listen, I got to try to understand why you support Trump. Because in every other respect, he's like the most respectful person. He really understands the ins and outs of policing. I mean, he's so smart about all of it. He regards drug dealers like he'll talk about them as running a business, you know, with some level of respect. And, you know, he just said that he really doesn't like Trump, but he just really hated Hillary that much.
No, I was about to say, is he a white man?
Yes.
What, nobody hate Hillary Clinton more than white men. White men are the number one
official. Well, he had like a personal interaction with her, which was sort of like, and on her security team. And, you know, those stories have been around about her. I mean, there might have been another candidate perhaps that could have bridged those gaps more successfully, but I thought that was interesting.
I've never seen one, and I don't generalize. Not a general, but I try my best not to be Mr. Generalization over here. But every time, like, the people that hate Hillary Clinton the most, I'm like, yo, why white men hate her? White men hate Hillary Clinton.
Because they watch, I mean, they've had a 20-year propaganda campaign against her, and, you know, Fox News, like, that's what made Fox News, was trashing her, and then all of the other sort of conspiracies. And I mean, but I don't have a lot to say to defend her in terms of policies or whatever. But I do. I mean, you remarked.
You won't get to be a white man if you say something positive about Hillary Clinton. They're going to take your
white
manness.
My father is in love with her.
They're going to strip it away.
More problems than a mathematician. Playing games with real digging, that's a bad decision. Ask me how I've been living. I replied, been chilling, trying to stack this.
So, I mean, you said earlier, though, that you know, you asked how many people died in our uprising. And I think it's important that no one died. And I fear that that won't happen again, that if we were to have the same kind of mass protests that we had here in 2015, even the ones we had the year before that, when there were sort of the leading up to the uprising with after Darren Wilson wasn't charged with shooting, once they didn't indict him for shooting Mike Brown, Baltimore really got in the streets. But I mean, already the cops were in the riot gear, were almost unrestrainable. And I fear that feeling like the DOJ has their back will really exacerbate the worst elements and make it harder for anyone who would be more level-headed within the force to respond correctly in those moments. So I fear that when we see these uprisings happening around the country, that we're going to start seeing protesters and stuff ending up dead somehow through them. And I really am.
Yeah, because it's getting crazy. I mean, people are really getting, like, these white supremacists, they out here killing people. Like, people, they're killing people that don't even, like, you know, like the college kid, he was just trying to catch the shuttle back to campus, about to graduate. Dude from nowhere just put a knife in him, you know. The other guy, the racist guy in Portland who killed the guy who was trying to stop him from harassing Muslims, like, he probably didn't know that he was going to be murdered. Like, two
people.
And time and time again, like, we're not calling these people terrorists. We're not, you know, as in media, like, I remember seeing a website called, I hate to say the same thing over again, but I saw a website called Brock Turner, a swimming attacker. Like, no, he's a rapist. Like, oh, well, you can't lock him up. It's going to ruin his life. Duh. Like, it's.
I don't think most of the people who write those stories or those headlines are stupid. I just don't think anyone has sat down and said, your job is to peel away the rhetoric and to, like, come up with the more appropriate language, you know? So they just repeat the headlines. I mean, that's what they do. They just repeat headlines, you know?
We need to call these people terrorists. We need to demonize these people. You know, like, even like, you know, like right now, Jared Kushner is being called like a naive and young person when, you know, if a black person gets caught with some drugs when he's like 16, he's like, charge him as an adult. He's a menace to society. He's horrible. He's never getting a chance to be a child. Like, they keep playing these games. We just not addressing these elephants that's in the room.
I think, like, the New York Times is slightly sometimes more responsible, at least with the Freddie Gray case. Like, they didn't do the Bolt headline. Everyone else did and said that the medical examiner said it. But who's going to be, like, which of these major media outlets that doesn't have the respect of the Times is going to have the guts to, like, say something in a headline that nobody else is saying that's actually the truth, you know? That takes, like, a lot of balls, and they're all scared shitless, you know? About advertisers and whatever, legal stuff. I mean,
And you just mentioned Richard Collins, who was murdered here and was a lieutenant as well as being graduating from
Blue
State.
Where support the troops people at? Where the fuck is exactly. They at? Like, where are the people who love the troops? I support the troops at? The same thing with Walter Scott. He was in the National Guard, just like the stupid ass cop that shot him. But it's like, where are these people at? And then you call them racist. They're like, you can't call me a racist. No, motherfucker, you a racist. That's why you're not saying nothing.
I mean, it's the same with the Tyree Woodson case that I've been working on for so long. They say he's got a gun into the police department and shot himself instead of shooting police officers. But they've never done anything to say, oh, this is how it happened. We're going to improve security. We're like, where are the Blue Lives Matter people there that, like, that endangered everyone in that precinct, if the story's true? And there's not been one call from the union to be like, oh, you got to, you know, and it's like, where are those people in those cases?
And that's, you know, when you said the union protects cops, I wanted to say something. They really don't protect cops like a Joe Crystal, for instance.
Right.
They are very political. They protect Brian Rice, Lieutenant Brian Rice on this case. The article, I think this is in the episode, but, like, just to read it again, the article in The Sun about Brian Rice going literally from he was harassing and stalking his ex or, you know, abusive behavior to, well, but the head of the FOP thinks that that's unlikely because he's a good guy, you know? So there's just a political body, too. And it's really, and unfortunately for the cops that are out there, the good ones, they pay their dues. They might not get the support they need, you know, from their own union.
And the union is very, I mean, it's interesting in this case. So internal affairs is not separate from the union, but is part of the union. So there was an event here 6 months ago or so where the union was having its conference in Baltimore. So the activists went and locked themselves to the rails and all kinds of stuff at the FOP conference. When I watched FOP members shove protesters against the wall, not ones who were working as security, but people who were just there. And so when we tried to get the IAD, we're looking at it. The officer who interviewed me about it from IAD was also involved in a lawsuit against the police department to make sure that any internal affairs documentation about any officers couldn't go to the civilian review board. So like, along with the FOP. So one of the IAD investigators was in a lawsuit as the plaintiff with FOP, a joint plaintiff, against the police department to make sure records stayed secret. And she was supposed to be objectively investigating FOP members for pushing protesters.
Wow. FOP goes after the police department a lot. I don't know that that's always understood. Not that there's any good guys here. It's just two political bodies, you know, often at war with each other. They really hate Kevin Davis. And they didn't like Bats either, so.
I think Davis is a nice guy. I think he has good intentions. I think he's a nice guy, like, at the core. Like, the only reason why I'm not dead right now was because of instinct. I just really, really genuinely think that he's a nice guy. I think that he has a job that's part of a system that, you know, where people just aren't fucking nice. Like, they just don't really give a fuck. I don't know how much he understands about what the perspective of a black person coming out of Baltimore City is. You know, his experience is way different. I don't know if he understands. I definitely think he's intellectually curious, which is always something that is like a positive quality in people who are curious to understand these different things. But I think that, you know, at the core, I just think sometimes nice people get caught up in the wrong shit.
What do you make about him being the pretty strong candidate for the person who was leaking stories about Freddie Gray hitting a bolt in the head the day before those officers were charged?
I think that he's caught up in some shit that just perpetuates evil. And that's it. Like, I mean, I think Bats was a fucking horrible person. You know what I'm saying?
Well, in terms of like corruption, they don't get a whole lot worse than that, for sure.
he's like leading the league in corruption. He's like fucking LeBron of corruption.
But I mean, on the other hand, Bats was deeply, deeply hated by the union, in part because, I mean, during the protest the previous fall here, when the rest of the country was having protests and the police would wear riot gear, Bats wouldn't let them wear riot gear. And all of those remained really peaceful because it kept the cops calmed down. And so Bats had his I mean, and the thing he did by you know, that they're so furious about telling the officers to stand down, you know, they made it like it was just a mistake. But he was also the Oakland police chief during Fruitvale,
right.
And he had the same exact
it's a philosophy.
The same strategy, and so
it's like this shit follows him.
On the one hand, it's a good thing that his strategy was don't go in there and crack heads. You know, a lot of other people, previous commissioners, would have had that strategy. So I think during the time that we had him for just for the protests, that it turned out to be okay for the city.
They cracked Joe head. Shit.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
the fuck? Like,
yeah, no doubt.
Well, he's a photographer. Did you see that video, Aaron?
I did see. I did see that video. I didn't get. They sent another one of my colleagues to, and this is before I was working for Mike. They sent another one of my colleagues to Baltimore to cover, you know, to gather what we could of, you know, some original reporting. I do remember seeing that as I was monitoring my. My Twitter feed.
I like Joe's response on Twitter the next day. Like, they hit like girls.
I mean, to be clear, for the
I think he said something like it didn't hurt, or they hit like girls, or something like that. Joe said something Joe-ish.
Right.
So for the listeners, so we're not just talking about something that no one has any idea what we're talking about. On the Saturday after the I mean, and also it's important and got overlooked when, you know, riots supposedly broke out at Camden Yards. That was started by sports fans who started throwing beers, racial slurs and stuff at protesters who were coming by. And then there was pretty severe fight. And then there was the smashing of police cars and stuff. Later that night, at the Western District, it was like the police were going to make people pay for that, is what it appeared like. So there were about 100 officers and maybe 30 people who lived in the neighborhood and almost no press out there. And so at one point, a guy was shadow boxing in front of an officer, like he acting like he was going to hit him and saying, "Hey, you," and it was personal animus saying, "Remember last week when I couldn't say anything? Now you can't say shit." And he's telling him everything that he wanted to say. So they decide they're going to get this guy, and they like pull back like a slingshot. And as they start running for him, they take out both of the photographers who are on the scene. But so they knock down the city paper photographer, stomping on him. And as they're pulling him away, he managed to get the shot anyway. And you see the shot of the billy club hitting the guy in the head. So they weren't specifically targeting press just because they were against press, but they were trying to get press out of the way so they could get who they wanted to get. And so that was and I filmed it, and you hear my voice in there yell, "He's a photographer! It's press!" It's super loud, and it got sampled in a Young Buck song, weirdly.
Oh, yeah.
Vaina was $1,500 for a feature.
For a verse.
Yeah, so anything closing you guys want to say? Start with Justine.
Well, it's off topic. It's just something I've been thinking about is... I feel like it's now important for me to try to, because I talk to police, to try to engage on these issues. I think it's a lot to ask for a community that's been traumatized by police officers in their personal lives and historically to take on having to challenge police by themselves. So that's why I think it's important for, it's something that I can emotionally take on. It's not hurting me now to deal with police officers, talk to police officers, try to advocate for reform. So I just think there needs to be a lot of allies. And I think that's across the board with other issues, too. When you have people who are deeply traumatized by a system or by a group of people. Now I have a better sense of the importance of allies, that it's just asking too much for the community to do it alone.
Boehner?
Yeah, I mean, I'd want to come back maybe to how we need more reporters. We need more people who are able to go and dig through. I mean, one of the things that the problems we had at City Paper with during this time is we weren't equipped really at all to do the kind of investigative work to really try to dig into what happened, because partly we were trying to keep up with what was happening around us, and we felt much closer to the community of people who were protesting than we did. That felt like our people more than the police. But you know, rather than, I mean, I like the Sun reporters and thought they did good work at a lot. Like Catherine Rentz, I think, did some really spectacular work. And like you mentioned Puente's story, we wouldn't have had the uprising without people knowing all of those other cases and having seen that. And so we need more people being able to dig more. And it takes forever. It takes a lot of time, and no one wants to pay for it, and no one wants to deal with it, you know, on a business level. But that's what we need. And not only when national eyes are here, we don't just need people wanting to hire someone locally for a little while and then you don't have that anymore because it's not sexy or whatever anymore. We need people who are looking at the Baltimore police every day, not just the day the DOJ report comes out or just the day that Freddie Gray dies.
Yeah, I guess even to put what you said in context, I wrote a story for the city paper, the Guardian, and the New York Times in the same night. It's like it's not enough reporters.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Aaron.
Well, I mean, one of the things that if I were to close with anything, is just reiterating that I think we just need more stories about the humanity of the folks who are impacted by these incidents. Something that we had a real big success with at Mike was this project we called 23 Ways. And so it took, you know, just looking at it very simply, what was the victim doing in their ordinary life at the time that they came into contact with the police officer? And sometimes when you frame it that way, you start to see that they were doing things that, in a lot of cases, doing things that most of us would go about doing in our everyday lives. And we, you know, we take for granted, or we don't live under a police state where, you know, everything we do, every move we make is watched by, you know, a sort of occupying force. And so I think just really thinking differently about the, you know, how these people live their lives on a day-to-day basis, and then they come into a really tragic and, you know, disaster strikes their family. And I think more needs to be done about that. I mean, I just think about it in this way. Like, if I get into a car and I don't buckle my seatbelt and a cop sees me I'm getting a ticket. So why is it that if you don't buckle Freddie Gray in to a police van, no one, apparently no one is responsible for that? I think that it, when you frame it in that way, then people can really understand it that way. But when you start talking about it, all these things are important. Of course, the leaks and the narrative that the law enforcement puts out, and all of sort of the things that happen on the periphery around these cases. But when you really just get right down to it, is this officer or are these officers being treated like everyone else in the community? And the answer is no. And if the answer is no, then I think we all, we have to do something about that. We cannot stop reporting on these things. We cannot be worried about fatigue and that people are like, oh God, another police involved death, another shooting. No, I think if we do a better job of telling the stories about the lives who are impacted by these incidents, then you know, maybe we'll see some change in our lifetimes.
Thank you. Yeah, and I just, you know, I feel like I've been saying some things more than once. I feel like I've heard these same stories my whole life. I feel like hearing a lot of the information that has been presented by the collection of wonderful guests we had on this show has just already doubled down on how I already felt. Like, it's just not an organization. Police officers in this country, they're just not here for me. Like, they're not here for me. Like, that's not their job description. Their job description is to do exactly what they're doing. So when I hear things like the DOJ and all that, I don't feel like, you know, or when I see like big black figures or big political figures or people who they got love and respect, or they out there speaking for the black community, when they see hope in these things, I'm like, yo, do their Google button work? Like, these things already happened before. So the biggest step, in my opinion, is how do we as people who are from these communities or are part of these communities or love these communities empower the residents there and help them get into positions where they can all have the information needed to be able to get their stories in the media or to experience success in different ways or to be able to, you know, because I don't even think you can earn or educate your way out of this stuff, because it's really a us versus them thing. Like, you can't, it's like certain things that you can't do. So, you know, I'll continue to do my best to try to get as much information to the people that need it as I can, and continue to act fake like I'm from Missouri and be the show me guy. Like, you gotta show me something, because right now they're not showing me anything. Justine, where can we find you at on social media?
Juicestein3000 on Twitter.
And Baynard?
Yeah, Baynard Woods. Yeah, on Twitter. Sorry.
There's an at in the front.
Where's that at?
Yeah, at Baynard Woods.
Democracy and Crisis, too, right?
Or yeah, at Demo and Crisis. And yeah, I have the site Democracy and Crisis and a podcast there.
All right, cool. And Aaron, where can we find you at?
At Aaron L. Morrison on Twitter and on Mike.com on the movement. We have a movement vertical subpage, and it's all of our social justice from the front lines coverage that you can, a lot of great reporters working on. It's just really covering the movement from all angles.
You can find me on all social media at DWAC as well. I want to thank this week's amazing guests, Justine Byrne, as always, Aaron Morrison, and Baynard Woods. You guys were great. Fans, you can discuss the episode with the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda using the hashtag UDAddendum, and follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram handle at Undisclosed. Thank you and have a great day.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum along with super producer Methil Telhan. A big thanks this week to our sponsor, 74 Seconds, a podcast featuring the story of Philando Castile. To our fans, go check out that podcast and continue to support our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The in-bed track is Timeless by FMG Dez. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 13. Until then.